Nerves were what happened to other people. "Let's make him a present," she declared. "Something to welcome him home. Something he can't possibly ignore." Turning on her heel, she marched back into the aisles. "Well, are you coming?" Behind her, Sirius looked suddenly downcast. Denied his master's return, he hung his head and sloped after her, grovelling as he came. Human beings, he had decided, were the most inscrutable things.
"Here we are," said Kathy. "Might I take your boots?"
Casper stopped in the bedroom doorway, tilting his ragged face up to take in the room. Kathy hoped it was stirring something in him, for what he saw was a snapshot of the day he had left the Emporium behind. In the 3 years since, she had not touched a thing, dusting carefully around each ornament, making certain every toy soldier would be standing to attention, just as on the day he had left. If only to have something to say, she bade him sit at the end of the bed. Levering off his boots was easy. He winced as the shockwaves worked through his body. But his legs were weak and they slipped right off. So many parts of his body were unfamiliar. His left foot had only 3 toes, and on the right the ends of each were worn down to stumps. Yet there was a silver lining in every black cloud. Casper was so detached that he did not see her recoil, nor how her left hand grappled her right to stop it from lifting to her mouth. Did he need rest? Did he need air? Did he need company? She had no way of knowing, and so, falling back on the lessons they had learned together as they watched Martha grow, she promised to return with milk for his bedside and a hot water bottle for his bed. By the time she came back, Casper was propped up in bed, an angular form beneath the blankets. In his lap, the music box played its lament, while the mice danced erratically on top. His head was hanging down, lost in the twirling of the mice, but all around him were splinters and shards of broken wood. Every toy soldier who had stood so proudly on the shelves, waiting for their general to return, was destroyed. All that was left were pieces of painted faces, peering expressionless out of the ruin. That night, she crawled into bed beside her husband, not knowing if it was the right thing to do. The heat from his body had warmed the sheets, and that was the most alien thing. His back was turned to her. She tried to hold him, but it felt all wrong. She turned against him, and that felt wrong as well. So, instead, she lay awake. Sometime in the night, Casper must have woken too, or perhaps he never slept at all, for she heard the lilting melody of the music box. Soon after that he returned to his slumber, more peaceful than before. The melody did nothing for Kathy. In the morning she woke and went about her business, but Casper remained. Sometimes he could be seen in the workshop. He took out tools he had not touched in years and tinkered with the music box, then retreated with it to his room or some unseen cranny of the Emporium floor. The shop floor itself had changed since he had been gone. Kathy was afraid he'd get lost, but Sirius took to following him at a distance, always ready to lead him back. In the evenings, Mrs. Hornung brought him food. At first the plates came back untouched, but soon she understood that he had reverted to the dishes of his boyhood, that he found comfort in those old textures and tastes. After that she made only his vareniki and kasha broths. Sometimes Papa Jack sat with him as he ate. Other times Emil came. He was desperate to introduce Casper to his wife, to fill Casper's head with the stories of the seasons he had missed, but Kathy pleaded with him not to. Casper took it all in but said nothing, returning each time to the music box in his hands. Whether it was day or dead of night, his fingers were never more than a whisper away from it. Even when Martha stole through to sit at the end of his bed, he would not acknowledge her. He wound and rewound the music box and lay back, stupefied. "He doesn't want to be back, does he, Mama?" Martha sobbed as Kathy put her to bed at night. "Your papa is very unwell, Martha. But one day, It's the music box. Why does he always listen to the music box?
Kathy did not know, but she resolved to find out. That night, when he slept, she teased it out of his hands. Without its touch, his sleeping grew fitful. She took care not to wake him and sat at his bedside, her fingers trembling over the crank. Why she hesitated, she did not know, and yet it took some courage before she began to play it. The contraption turned at her command, the mice began to dance, and the music drifted up to bewitch her. It was a sensation like so many other Emporium toys. The sounds were so perfect, the dance so particular, that she no longer felt like Catherine Godman, 27-year-old mother and stalwart of Papa Jack's Emporium. The toy had touched her somewhere deep inside, and now she was Kathy Ray, 5 or 6 or 7 years old. The edges of the bedroom she shared with Casper seemed to evaporate, and out of the haze appeared the furniture and fittings of that little room she and Lizzie used to share, in an age that seemed so long ago. The longer the music played, the more real things seemed, the richer the colours, the deeper the textures. On the bedside sat the copy of Gulliver's Travels, on the shelf the wooden rabbit. She had felt this way once before, that moment many years ago when Papa Jack gave her one of his pinecone ballerinas, and soon the only reason she knew it was not real was because, when she looked down, it was the hand of an adult still turning the handle of the music box. The music soared, and suddenly she could perceive the Emporium no longer. Whatever spell the toy was weaving, her childhood had grown solid, undeniable around her. There was movement in the corner of her eye, and when she looked up, the door opened to reveal Lizzie, 5 years old. By instinct, Kathy opened one arm to receive her. It was then that she saw. She no longer had the arm of an adult. It was a child's arm that reached out to Lizzie. She was wearing the white pinafore dress that her mother kept for Sunday best. Lizzie nestled into her shoulder and Kathy gave in, returning the embrace. "Let's play, dear Kathy," Lizzie cried, and the voice, so familiar, echoed in her body. "Do you remember Polly?" Kathy did. It was the name of a game of skipping they used to play, up and down the estuary sands. She found herself saying, "But I can't, dear Lizzie." "And why ever not?" asked her sister. "Don't you see," said Kathy, "I'm not really here. I have to keep winding. If I don't keep winding, none of this exists." Her sister looked at her quizzically. "Winding what, dear Kathy?" Kathy looked down. By some miracle, both her hands were free. The music still played, but it was distant now. A solemn song at the back of her head, and of the music box she could see no sign. "Where is it?" Kathy cried. She leapt to her feet. In her panic, she did not see that her arm was adult again. Something in her frenzy had brought it back. She whirled around, spied the music box sitting on the bed, and snatched it up. The crank handle had been turning of its own accord. She seized it, stopped it from moving. The mice resisted, determined to dance on, but she held it fast and watched, with relief, as the old bedroom fragmented around her. The last thing she saw was Lizzie's plaintive face calling out, "Come back, Kathy! Kathy, come back! Don't you want to play?" The music stopped. Kathy cast the music box down and, when she looked up, she was in the gloom of the Emporium again. Casper whimpered in his sleep, words without form, though their meaning was clear. In his dreams he was 300 miles away, trapped in a foxhole in the French earth. She slid back into bed beside him. Now at least she knew where Casper was whenever he went away. He was 20 years away, in a world without Kathy and Martha, a world without death, a world in which the only wars were waged across the Emporium carpets. Back when he and Emile were brothers in arms, and if he wanted to stay there, thought Kathy, and live those moments again, well, who was she to say otherwise? As she lay down, Casper called out. He cried for his mamma, and somehow his sleeping fingers found the music box where it had landed. Cathy heard that haunting melody again and wished him well on his way. "Stay away from him, Martha," her mother had said. "Give him his peace. Lord knows he's earned it." Well, what about her? What had she earned across all these years? 3 Christmases without a father, 3 birthdays, 1,000 nights of going to bed and folding her hands and saying her prayers. Sometimes she had dreamed about him. She had written little notes, tied them to the leg of a pipe-cleaner bird, and hoped it might somehow flutter all the way to France. All that had to count for something. Or what was everything for? Martha strained with the bamboo cane in her hand. She strained too hard, and it snapped. No matter. She would just start again. She had resolved that she was going to finish his gift today, and nothing was going to stop her. Accordingly, the Wendy House floor, for it was this that she had designated her workshop, was itself a battlefield, littered with the carcasses of her past attempts. This morning her frustration was mounting. She did not want to give up. The principle was simple, but only as far as every Emporium toy seemed simple on the surface. A steam train, built from a frame of bamboo, would hurtle along until it crashed headlong into a wall. The resultant explosion would crumple the bamboo in such a particular fashion that, when it sprang back into being, it would now be a locomotive headed in the other direction. In that way, the train could bounce back and forth between 2 workshop walls all day long. Imagine the games that could be played, Martha thought. But then, upon seeing the wreckage spilled around her, her heart sank. Ambition, Papa Jack had said, was only the first step to producing a perfect toy. After that, you had to have art. It was, she reluctantly decided, time to get help. Her mother would not be any use. Papa Jack would be sleeping, so Uncle Emile it would have to be. She found him in his own workshop, whittling away yet more toy soldiers out of a great trunk one of the Emporium's foresters had delivered at summer's end. His favourite toy, the Imperial Capitan, was watching over him as always it did. "It doesn't work," she said, depositing the tangles of canes and cotton twine at his feet. "I know what it's meant to do, so why won't it do it?" Emile, who had been too engrossed in his own work, looked up. This was a sentiment he had known all of his life. He set down his lathe, moved aside the paints and pots of varnish, and considered the concoction Martha had brought. "Let me see," he began, and sat cross-legged beside her. He lifted the mess, rearranged the canes and joists until it took the form of a locomotive again. She had planned a miraculous design, but it was little wonder she had not made it work. A thing like this took a lifetime's nuance, yet he found himself inordinately proud that she had envisaged it. She was, without doubt, an Emporium girl. "It's for my papa," said Martha as Emile continued to fiddle. "I see. To make him better." Emile remained silent, working out a particularly knotty joint. "What do you think is wrong with my papa, Uncle Emile?" Emile whispered. "I don't think I could ever understand." "I thought a toy would help. It's what Papa Jack says. A toy can't save a life, but it can save a soul. Well, my papa's alive, but..." "There," Emile said, thankful to be bringing the conversation to an end. He set the toy down, and now, when Martha looked, it seemed sleeker and more crisply defined than ever. The key in its back would set it running. Martha turned it and watched it fly. Soon it was hurtling toward the naked wall. Its whistle, Martha had not thought of a whistle, it must have been Emile's addition, trilling all the way. She rose to the tips of her toes in anticipation. The train bore down on the wall. There came an almighty crash. And the next thing she knew, the canes had concertinaed, parts fanning out and twisting around. An instant later, the threads binding it all together grew taut, contained the explosion, and the flying parts collapsed back into place. Now, just as she had hoped, the locomotive had reassembled itself, facing in the other direction. It came screaming towards her. She threw her arms around Emile and gushed out her thanks. As Emile watched her leave, he felt that strange longing again. the one that had been plaguing him ever since Kathy brought Caspar home. How he hungered to go up there and hold his brother's hand. How he hungered to show him the long war, to settle down with Caspar and make mindless battle across carpets, floors and aisles. And yet, something always stopped him. Something always held him back. Whatever it was, it would not permit him to sit at Caspar's side. So he sat back to his workbench, picked up his lathe, and continued his work. Sometimes it was the only thing that could bring him peace of mind. With the locomotive cradled in her arms, Martha burst through the bedroom door. Inside it smelt of the bedpan and sour milk. Her papa was upright in bed, buttressed by pillows on every side. In his lap, a papery hand, ridged with veins, was turning the handle of the music box. Occasionally, as the mice danced, his lips twitched with a smile. Sirius was lying across his feet, guarding his shrunken legs. He eyed her warily, judging if he ought to let her near. She had decided that she would be strident. And so, ignoring the smell, ignoring the growling of the dog, she strode to the edge of the bed and held up the train. "Papa, it's for you." Caspar remained as he was, mindlessly turning the crank. But Martha would not be deterred. She set the train down and watched with mounting glee as it exploded against one wall, reassembled itself, and then exploded against another. She watched the volleys three times, cheering with every collision, before she turned back to her father. And still Caspar remained, lost in the melody, and whatever cherished landscapes the box was creating. He wasn't even in the room, Martha realized. Wherever he was, it was not here. She leapt onto the bed. Before she knew it, she was straddling him, her two hands grasping the music box and trying to tear it from his lap. She did not realize, until much later, that Sirius had closed his muslin jaws around her leg. He was wrestling with her just the same as she was wrestling with her papa. Despite the way he slumped, there was strength in her father's fingers. Those brittle things would not release the music box, no matter how hard she tried. Even as she fought, he was continuing to wind it. The music billowed up around her. "Papa!" she screamed. And realizing at last that Sirius was mauling her, she kicked out and sent him flying from the bed. "It's for you!" Something cracked inside the music box. At last, she ripped it from his hands. His fingers were left clasping the crank handle. But the box was hers. She flung the wretched thing aside, down past Sirius, down into the path of the unstoppable locomotive. Had she tried, she would still have been too slow to stop it. The steam train whistled in fury and barreled straight into the stranded box. Canes exploded, strings drew taut, and though the locomotive reassembled to hurtle raggedly in the other direction, the box was no more. Parts of it arced in every direction. The music was dead, but the silence was oppressive. Martha rocked back, Caspar still unmoving underneath her. "Papa," she repeated, "it's for you." Still he said nothing. He looked straight through her, and that was when Martha gave up. She clambered off her father, not caring for his cadaverous body underneath the sheets, and tramped back across the room. She did not take the toy train with her. It had been for her father, and whether he wanted it or not, that was where it would stay. That was what presents were for. Disconsolate, she dropped back to the Emporium floor. She had almost reached the sanctuary of the Wendy House when her mother caught her. Her mother had a sixth sense that told her when she had been crying. She clawed angrily at her eyes, as if that might mask the tears. "Darling, has something happened?" Martha could not hold it in, no matter how hard she tried. "It's my papa, he won't—" Her sentence faltered, for another sound was filling her ears. It was the clanking of bamboo pistons, the shrill call of a whistle, and from along the aisle, the miniature locomotive burst into sight. It passed between Martha and her mother, disappeared into the paper trees and returned, slightly worse for its explosion against the Wendy House wall. Martha tracked it with her eyes, back along the aisle, back through the open boxes where Emile's long war boxes were waiting to be displayed, and between the knock-kneed legs that had loomed into view. She gazed up. There stood her papa, a wraith in a dressing robe, black hair entangled with black beard. His whiskers were crusted in the white runoff of his drool. "Caspar?" her mother breathed. But she was the second to reach him. Martha was already there, with her arms wrapped around his legs. The Rising. Papa Jack's Emporium, Winter, 1917 to 1918. October turned into November, but still there was no frost. News came that John Horwood, the Emporium caretaker who had been presumed dead on the Somme, was alive and well, though none would recognise him if he ever returned, for his jaw had been left in the Flanders earth, and now he wore a new one made of ivory and India rubber. Every day the Emporium shelves grew deeper, new displays appearing in the alcoves and other expanses. It was the time of year that Cathy liked best, those evenings of anticipation, wondering if tonight was when the first crystals of white might appear. And this year, more than any other, she had reason to cheer. For there was her Caspar, back in his workshop, working on his toys. Here he was now. Cathy peeped through the gap in the workshop door, and watched as he turned the concoction of felt and fabric in his hands, adjusting its insides with the miniature tools from his bench. He held his body, that body he would never let her hold, differently now. But in his eyes something of the old Caspar remained. Around him, the workshop counters were littered with fragments of the music boxes that, in his weaker moments, he had been trying to recreate. That he had given up on each new version was the thing that made Cathy know he was still as proud and stubborn as the day they had met. Her heart gave a flutter when she saw him set down his new creation and smile. Never had one of those smiles, once so irrepressible, so infectious, meant more to her than it did now. The patchwork rabbit was a dainty thing. It had a key in its side that was slowly winding down, and it hopped along, as rabbits do, until it found a few scraps of fabric left on the workshop floor. At these it bent down and started to eat. Caspar sprinkled more felt, and the rabbit hopped after its forage and gobbled it up. Next, Caspar scattered bits of bent iron, a few screws, a length of copper wire. The rabbit devoured it all. Then, at the last, it stopped hopping altogether. It hunched against the cold furnace wall, furrowed its embroidered eyes, and, out of a knot in the fabric of its posterior, there popped another rabbit, this one even daintier than the last. As the adult rabbit's motor wound down, the babies came alive. Eagerly, it hopped back toward Caspar, searching out any scraps of food its mother had missed. Sensing movement behind her, Cathy turned to see Martha approaching along the shadowed hall. Putting a finger to her lips, she whispered, "Come and see." And with a footfall soft as Emporian snow, Martha scurried to her mama's side. She was about to peep through the door, where another patchwork rabbit was birthing a kit, when a sound echoed up the hall. Three short blasts, the sound of a bugle, the sound of the bugle that announced first frost. Martha looked up at her mother, her face opening in delight. "Oh, Mama!" Cathy pushed open the door. The room was silent. Where Caspar once sat, there was only an empty chair. Around its legs, the patchwork rabbits gave their last little hops as their motors wound down. With no felt left to feast on, or transform, in whatever intricate motors Caspar had devised, they huddled together as they grew still. "Where is he, Mama?" "Go to the shop floor," Cathy whispered, forcing a smile. "Going to need all the help they can get." Cathy took off, through the cluttered workshop and up the servant's stair to the quarters above. She had hoped to find Caspar in the bedroom, but he was nowhere to be found. She checked every cranny before she returned to the workshop below. She was hurrying through when she recalled the forest green toy box from the summer Martha was born. There it sat, crammed between two crates of cast-offs and a bale of satin lace. The lid was askew, hinting at the darkness within. Cathy heaved it aside. Being one of the earliest Casper had made, it had always been the smallest of the toy boxes. From the lip she could see Casper lying 6 feet below, seeming to cringe from the light. "Casper, my love, it was only the bugle. It's to be opening night." Casper rolled. For a moment Cathy thought that he was fitting, but it was laughter that rattled his body. "Mrs. Godman, you must think me awfully strange." Cathy remembered a conversation of so long ago. Awfully sentimental, perhaps. "Aha," sighed Casper. "Well, there you have it. For if a toy maker cannot be sentimental, who on this blasted earth can?" Tonight the heavens inside the Emporium were laid bare for all to see. As the doors opened and the first families flocked in, constellations exploded above them. Stars were born, died, and reformed. Angels of light galloped through the blackness. A heavenly host was picked out in cascades of paper, and as the swirling mass settled, the outlines of toys could be seen gazing back down. Here was the constellation of the patchwork dog. Here the Imperial Capitan and his loyal wind-up soldiers. It was snowing across the Emporium, and cheering erupted in every alcove and aisle. In one of those alcoves, grasping Martha by one hand and Cathy by the other, and with Sirius, loyal as ever, sitting at his side, stood Casper. His eyes pointed upward, but his body was quaking. As the snowfall broke, his trembling slowed down. "Is it good, Papa?" A night of falling stars, of explosions in the heavens, more magical than any other opening night. And yet these things, they were not so out of the ordinary for Casper. He was still trembling as he said, "They put on a good show. I couldn't have done it better myself." But then he broke free of both their hands and stepped into the aisle, where the first customers were hurrying through. It had been all women last year, women and their children. Now there were others, a cripple on his crutches, a gentleman who wheezed with every breath. No wonder they were drawn back, thought Cathy. After everything that had happened, who wouldn't long for the time before? "I should like to see some toys," said Casper. "There's so much I've missed." And Cathy, thinking that a good thing, let him drift on. Cathy had much to attend to, for most of the shop hands, 3 seasons old, still needed her to cluck around them like a mother hen. Martha, meanwhile, was determined to keep watch. She followed him at a distance, pretending to peruse shelves whose contents she knew by heart. Casper headed first for the carousel, and next for the corrals, where the children were riding rocking horses with wild abandon. Casper recognized some of these horses, but many others had been crafted since he left. Martha watched him clamber onto the one she called Black Star, the king of all rocking horses the Emporium had ever made. He rode for some time, eyes screwed against an imaginary wind, before he clambered out of the saddle and wandered on. Sometimes he got lost. Aisles had been torn down, reassembled and torn down again, and he took to asking Sirius for directions, following wherever its nose led. And that was how, some time later, Casper strode into the glade where boys were playing at war. 12 skirmishes were being played out across the carpets. Gangs of boys crouched around what toy soldiers they had scavenged from the open boxes, wound them up and let them go. Tiny bugles sounded, wooden bullets flew, and all at once images raked across Casper's eyes. The first time he went up and over the top. The time he battled Emile in the bedroom while the new shop girl, mysterious Cathy Ray, watched on. How energized he had been then. How in awe. Now he was compelled to look the other way. The battle cries were too insistent, too loud. He cringed and found himself looking instead at a tower of cardboard boxes decorated by an expert hand. The stencils across the side were surrounded with a weave of Emporium soldiers in interlocking design. The words read, "The Long War." He had made an industry of it then. While Casper discovered real war, Emile brought their game to the world.
Adventure, the box declared. Glory! Your country needs you.
Casper turned away. There was a cabinet of other toys behind the tower, and, hoping to distract himself, he picked one up. It was another of Emile's creations. He could feel it in the weight and heft of the piece. Touching its crank handle, he felt the axle meshing with the mechanism inside. Against a diorama of cross-hatch hills and skeleton trees, tin soldiers were presented on spikes, as if peeping out of their foxholes. When he turned the handle, the soldiers rose, swiveling as if to bring their rifles to bear. Then, because a toy could only ever capture a moment in time, the soldiers retreated again, back into the safety of their dugouts, bound to repeat the same manoeuvre over and over, never seeing real battle, but never going back home. As Casper turned the handle for the third time, he heard, as if in the distance, the horns of war begin to sound, a single trumpeter turning into a chorus. A fourth time, and the edges of the aisles filled with sporadic bursts of tiny artillery fire, the miniature thunder of cavalry stampeding past, the alarm calls of whistles and officers bellowing at their rank and file. Casper did not look up from the toy, but as he turned the handle again and again, the borders of the shop floor fell away, the shelves dissolved into a blasted battlescape of trenches and barbed wire. It was then that the terror hit him. The rational part of him knew that he was safe, that it was only a game, the toy working on his imagination as toys are meant to do. But it was not the rational part of him in charge of his fingers. They kept turning the crank, solidifying all that he could see. And then he was back there, back where his fingers were grimed in scarlet and black, back in his uniform, with pieces of his second lieutenant's brain smeared across his face. His ears were full of the sounds, his nose was full of the smells. He screamed and screamed and screamed. It was a sound that had never been heard in the Emporium. Kathy was wrestling to wrap up a herd of toy sheep when she heard her husband's cry. Abandoning her post, she hurried into the aisles. She found Casper where he had fallen, his hands over his face. Sirius was trying to nuzzle him, but he didn't seem to know the dog. Martha was standing over him asking, "Papa, Papa, are you there?" as if she had not been asking the same thing every hour of every day since he returned. "What happened?" Kathy asked. Customers were being drawn into the glade. They craned to take a look over the tops of the aisles. Martha looked at her, face contorted as if that was answer enough. "Help me get him out of here," Kathy said, and, avoiding the thrashing of his limbs, tried to get her arms under his. "Martha? I'll fetch Uncle Emile." She was already darting off when Kathy shouted, "No, don't tell Emile!" She did not know why, but somehow that seemed important. "Just stop them all staring." With strength she did not know she had, Kathy lifted Casper to his feet and laboured him out of the depression. Though his arms had stopped thrashing, now he was a dead weight, slumped against her shoulder. By the time she reached the aisle where model tigers prowled the uppermost shelves, Martha had done her job. The Cloud Castle drawbridge had opened above them, and yet more lights were fountaining out, painting extravagant snowflakes in the air. This was distraction enough. Eyes no longer followed her as she dragged him along, and in that faltering way she brought him through the paper trees. In the Wendy house she laid him down. Sirius had followed. He whimpered miserably in the corner. "Casper?" On the bed he rolled, drawing his knees up to his chin. What a thin, angular body his was. At least he was in the room with her now. His eyes recognized her, but still those guttural noises came from the back of his throat. Kathy made room at the bedside. No matter what he wanted, she would touch him now. She went to grip him by the shoulders, but her fingers resisted. She had to battle herself to do it. "Casper, my love, what happened?" He choked with laughter again. "It's supposed to be a toy. How could a toy?" But then the laughter was silence, and into the silence came his sobbing. She tried to hold him closer, drawing him onto her knee, but there was strength in him yet. He rolled away, fists bunching up the bedclothes. My love, you have to tell me. Tell me what I can do.
This time he looked at her. He opened his hands and said, There is nothing.
You did it for me. You held me here, on this same bed, and told me I could do it, told me I was strong. So tell me, why can't I do it for you?
My Kathy, you can't. Her body was at odds with itself, just like his. Part of her wanted to throw herself down and lie beside him, but other parts could not bear to be there, her body repelling his just as his repelled her. Her disgust disgusted her, but that way lay madness. That way lay hate. Finally she screamed, Then you have to do it! I don't care what it is! I don't care how! But if you won't let me, then there's only you left! Do you understand? You didn't die out there, Caspar. You came back to us. Was it for a reason? Was it just plain luck? I don't know, but if you didn't die, you have to live. Because there isn't anything else.
Caspar's breathing slowed. His eyes, which had darted into so many corners as she spoke, settled on hers.
She missed you, Caspar.
Her voice cracked. She was as bad as him. Since when had she lost the ability to say what she meant?
We waited for you all this time, and you came back, and...
Then tell me. Tell me. How am I to...
I don't know, Kathy said. But you do. I've watched you build boxes with caverns inside them. I took shelter in here with you, while paper trees rained down from the sky. You transform things out here, Caspar. So why can't you transform things in there?
After that, they stared at each other for the longest time. Soon, Kathy heard footsteps beyond the Wendy House walls.
She's coming back.
Caspar promised me. You're alive, aren't you? You are alive. That night, Emile took his time to disrobe. First he picked every splinter of wood from his arms, where they had matted in the bristles of hair that grew thicker each year. Then he hung his work clothes carefully in the wardrobe, ready for another day's labour. Only after dousing himself liberally in the little tin sink did he step behind the screen and don the nightclothes Mrs. Hornung had left out for him. In the bedroom, Nina was already upright in bed, reading one of her novelettes. Emile had taken his notebook to bed, as had been his practice ever since he was a boy, but the marks he made tonight were scrappy and inconsequential. He drew the face of a soldier, supposed to be as regal as the Imperial Capitan, but instead the image looked bedraggled, worn, like a body whose soul had been spent. Like Caspar, Emile caught himself thinking, and promptly scoured the image clean away. He had not yet told their father about the scene Caspar had made in the glades of the Long War this evening. He wondered if he ever should. Emile, Nina had been watching him all along, do you want to tell me what's wrong? Emile lay with his hands folded beneath his face, the imitation of a sleeping angel. He rolled to face Nina. I don't know what to do with him, Nina. I see Kathy trying to cradle him, and he won't be cradled. I want to go to him myself, but...
But what?
But how can I? I'll say the wrong thing. I'll make out like I understand, but I don't. How could I? Nina ran a finger along the thick thatch of his eyebrows. This is your home, Emile. You shouldn't have to creep around it like you don't belong. Don't you belong here? Don't I? What your brother sacrificed, that shouldn't have to...
You don't understand. He's Caspar. He's the one who made the paper forests. He's the one who built the toy boxes with all those caverns inside. We've been waiting for him to... Do you know what I see when I see your brother, Emile? I see a man. That's all. A lonely man. A broken man. But still, just a man.
Look at what you did these winters, Emil. Look at the ledger books.
A paper tree that lives and dies. But a game like the Long War, that goes on and on and on, children devote themselves to it. You don't think that's a marvel, just as good as all of the rest? Everything she was saying was true, and yet...
I miss my brother, he whispered. It isn't right to say it, and who knows if he missed me, but...
I miss him, Nina. I want him home.
He is home.
Emil shook his head, as fierce as a toddler just discovering the motion. For a while, Nina said nothing. She lay with her own hands folded beneath her face. Then she reached out, took Emil's, and guided it down. Emil tried to resist. This was not the moment. How could she feel romantic when... but gave in when he found his hand had been cupped around her belly. I know you miss him, Emil. I think it might be the sweetest thing about you, how much you love your brother. But your family's bigger now, and it's growing bigger still. She paused, waiting for the gears in Emil's mind to start turning. I saw my aunt's physician. It's certain. He believes there may even be twins. Emil's eyes widened with every utterance. Imagine it, Emil. Twin boys gambling up and down the Emporium halls. Your boys. Our boys. Making their futures here. I'm sorry for your brother. I'm sorry the Emporium isn't going back to how it was. But, and this is important, so listen to me, my love. These last years, that's what the Emporium is to me. That's all the Emporium I've ever known. I don't want it to go back. I want it to go forward. I want you to be fit and fighting strong, and for the Long War to make your fortune. Because your children, she smiled, the simplest and most meaningful smile, and saw it mirrored in Emil's opening face, are going to need it. On the first day of December, with ragged snow streaming through the Marble Arch, Cathy wrapped herself against the winter and took the trolley bus west. Hyde Park was not blanketed in snow, but its pastures were dusted in a whiteness at the same time dirtier and more pure than the confetti snow with which she usually spent her winters. The banks of the Serpentine, where she had dozed with Casper in that summer so long ago, were alternately crisp with frost or deluged in dirt. But it had not stopped the families turning out to see the new memorial, nor the patients from St. George's venturing out to fill their lungs with the crisp, frigid air. St. George's loomed on the corner, half hidden behind the colonnades. As Cathy approached, a horse-drawn ambulance had stopped, and orderlies were striding out to help its occupant through the doors. Cathy followed after, to the whirlwind smells of iodine and carbolic soap. At a counter, a nurse was filling in papers. "I'm looking for Lizzie Ray," she began. "My sister. She's..." And here she brandished the letter she had received, its postmark already 2 months old. Lizzie, back from the base hospital and using her service leave to volunteer. It all seemed so unlikely. "I don't know a Lizzie," the sister replied, "but there's a Beth Ray working on Second Ward. Might that be..." Second Ward was not difficult to find. A convalescent floor, its patients reclined in the Saxe blue suits and scarlet ties that marked them out as soldiers at rest. Some of them were cajoling each other from the spaces between their beds, but more still were asleep or gathered on a terrace looking out at the snow. Only one nurse drifted between them, fixing sheets and piling bedpans on a trolley. When she finally looked up, Cathy realized how long it had been since she had seen her sister. Lizzie was older now, her eyes greyer, but above all else, in spite of the uniform, the places she had been, the grime beneath her fingernails, so alien to the girl she used to know, she was still the same beautiful Lizzie Ray. "Cathy!" "Beth?" Cathy ventured, with just a hint of admonition. Her sister rolled her eyes. "It was time for a change," she said. "Oh, Cathy, I wasn't sure if you'd got my letters." "Now I see that you have. I..."
I would have come to the Emporium. You know that, don't you? Only... Kathy understood. What could first frost matter when set against everything happening inside these hospital walls? The truth is, I'm only here another week. After that, I'm putting in a favour for a girl at Endell Street. It's women only there, did you know? Women nurses and women doctors, the whole thing. But by Christmas, I'll be gone. Kathy, she whispered, I've met somebody. He's back in Dieppe. Convalescent to start with, but back home he was a medical doctor. So now he's working the rounds. For a little while they talked of other things. Their mother was well, their father resigned from the cockle sheds to keep books for the munitions works on the other side of the estuary. If nothing else, and unless he did anything foolish, it would keep him from France. After that, there was only the small utterances and stilted conversations of people with too much time in between them. But Kathy had not come here to be reminded of what she had left behind. In the silences, she kept circling herself, searching for the courage to say what was on her mind. "Casper's home," she finally said. It felt better to get it out, and after she had said it, the words came more freely. "You saw him, Lizzie. What it did to him. Well, his body's healed. And yet..." Lizzie rushed forward, smothering her in her arms. "He's alive," she said. "I keep telling him the same thing, but he's changed as well. I thought he would come home and we'd pick up our lives, that we might even have all those children we'd talked about, brothers and sisters for Martha to play with in the Emporium halls. But how? How if he'll never touch me? How if I don't want to..." Lizzie shepherded her to a corner of the ward, where the bed sat empty, awaiting the next convoy. "It changes them in different ways. I've known men lose whole days. Some stop talking, some talk about nothing else. It used to be I could tell what he was thinking just by the creases of his eyes. Don't they say eyes are the windows to the soul? Well, with Casper, they're like the Emporium's secret doors. You look into them, but you don't see what's behind. I want to talk to him, but he doesn't want to talk. I want to hold him, but he won't be held. With other men, it would be the drinking, but with Casper..." That morning she had stood in the doors of his workshop. Felt rabbits had birthed more felt rabbits until there were no more left to birth. A woolen sheep was baaing incessantly, searching for the rest of its flock, oblivious to the fact that Casper had yet to craft them and probably never would. The silk suit that hung on the back of the door was grappling out with empty sleeves, wanting only to be hugged, and finding nothing to hold. Such things had been pouring out of him in the last days. Sometimes she woke in the night and he was not there. Sometimes she woke and he had been lying there all along. And as the weeks went by, it was increasingly difficult to tell one night from the next. "I don't know if I love him." It burst out of her, dripping with the shame she had been drowning in for days. "Oh, Kathy. I mean, I don't know how to love him. Can that be real? Can it wither like that? It's like a rot." Lizzie didn't say a thing. She reached out and held Kathy's hand. On Christmas Day, as every year, the tables were laid out on the shop floor, and the shop hands who remained brought up platters of food from the kitchens underneath. Mrs. Hornung, who was already a part of Emporium legend on account of her figgy pudding, had surpassed herself with the goose. It was stuffed with a partridge, which was itself stuffed with a songbird. The pastries were stuffed with pheasant, brought into the store as payment by a gamekeeper, whose wallet was empty, but whose children deserved so much more. Kathy and Martha busied themselves until, at last, the table was a mountain range with crags of roast gammon, foothills of potatoes roasted and mashed, A wilderness of parsnips reached up one of the escarpments and made a crown at its summit. The shop hands were already filling their plates when Emil and Nina appeared along the aisle, helping Papa Jack between them. As he settled, Kathy saw that he was balancing a pinecone soldier between his thumb and forefinger, constantly twirling it around. The toasts were short and sweet. "To the Emporium," said Emil, "to our families and our friends, at home and abroad. To moments like these, to my wife, and my sons yet to come, and my papa who started it all, and to my brother's return." At this he lifted his glass. His eyes followed it but did not look down again. Kathy looked the same way, and there was Casper, balanced on one of the galleries above. She started. Martha had started too. Kathy had to rein her back into her seat, and by the time she had dealt with her muttered protestations, Casper was gone. "I'll fetch him," she whispered in Martha's ear. "We didn't even invite him," she was saying. "Why didn't we invite him to our Christmas?" Kathy was barely out of her seat when he appeared along one of the aisles. From here he was slow in coming, resting on one of his canes. Twice he caught her eye and gave a mute nod, as if to promise he was fine. As he grew near, some of the shop hands didn't know where to look. "Eat," insisted Papa Jack. Sally Ann took the order to heart and continued to pile her plate high. Others moved reticently, but not one of them looked in his direction. Emil reached Casper in the same moment that Kathy came to his side. "I can still walk, little brother," Casper said, barely concealing his frustration. Then he was at the table. No place had been left for him, so suddenly Nina was on her feet. "There's really no need," Casper said. "It's customary to stand to make a toast." Casper held out a hand. Martha passed him a glass. "My friends, my family, my daughter, my wife." He was looking at them all so fiercely, but on his lips was that same infectious smile of old. "It has been a considerable thing to come home, to find you all here again, where you surely belong. With my hand on my heart, I can say that through every night I spent out there, I kept the image of you all in my mind. My papa and my brother, my Kathy and my Martha, Kesey and Dunmore and little Douglas Flood." His brittle hand had fallen to dance through Martha's hair. She squealed at his touch, looking up with little thrills of delight, and Kathy had to fight the compulsion to draw her away. It was only Casper, she told herself, the only father she'd ever known. "The Emporium is my home," he went on, and something in his voice began to show the frailty he had been working so hard to keep at bay. "This place is my beating heart, its storerooms and aisles, the dens where I used to play, and I know now that that is the only reason I came back to you, while so many of our friends perished. Because how could a man ever die when he doesn't carry his heart with him, when he's locked it away here at the bottom of his toy box with everything else he holds dear? The world outside those doors knows more sorrow than I dare remember. But in here there is snowfall of paper and rocking horses running wild. There are forest glades and butterflies of satin, trains that loop impossible loops, and patchwork dogs that never grow old and die. And there is the memory," he whispered, "of when we were two little boys who knew nothing other than our games." Emil had started to clap, but perhaps it was premature. Not one of the other shop hands joined in. "The Emporium has changed since I embarked," Casper went on. "But I'm home now. And I'm sorry, Emil. The Emporium must change again." He stopped to survey the room, taking in every face that was staring at his. From the moment the doors open tomorrow, and forever after, the Emporium will sell no more toy soldiers. There was silence, less stunned than perplexed, around the table. Let us put that in our past, like everything else.
Caspar, Emil ventured, what do you mean, no more?
It is a simple matter, my brother. There are so many magical confections in these halls. Why must we sully ourselves with soldiers any longer?
Now, Caspar, Emil said sterner now, listen here, the long war
is still going on, said Caspar. I know it is. He leant down to plant a kiss on Martha's brow. Then pitching into his cane, he returned along the aisle from which he had come, ignoring the cries that harried him on his way.
Eat! Emil exclaimed, and the shop-hands, who until now had maintained a reverential hush, began their mutterings as the tinkling of plates and forks dispelled the silence.
Well, it's preposterous, Kathy heard Emil go on, to think he can waltz in here and make a judgment like that. A judgment on all of us. It's ugly, that's what it is, isn't it, Papa? Well?
But Papa Jack said nothing. The old man sat slumped in his chair, his pinecone figurine still clasped between forefinger and thumb.
Trade began slowly next morning, as it always did once the festivities had died down. But by the small of afternoon a steady trickle of customers were filling the aisles, the rich children of Knightsbridge coming out to indulge their Christmas allowances. Emil, who spent the morning prowling the shop floor, if only to make certain that the boxes of the Long War still took pride of place on the carousels, put on his usual ebullient show whenever a boy asked him the way into his cloud castle or the secret tune that could make the dancing bears perform a fandango. Yet in his quiet moments his eyes kept searching, lingering on the galleries above in case his brother dared to be seen. The day was almost done, the shop floor emptying as customers gave up the dallying in which they had spent their days, when he heard the commotion. Balancing on one of the units, trying to draw down a dirigible, he pirouetted around. A rotund man was remonstrating with Kathy, his face, behind whiskers waxed as if to look incensed, turning scarlet with rage. A small crowd of onlookers had already formed. Through bobbing heads and arms flung skyward, Emil watched as the man set up two small units of soldiers on the counter, wound them up and let them go. It was a battle like any other, just the same as the thousands that had already been played with Emporium toys. In perfect formation, the soldiers marched at one another. These were infantrymen, armed with only bayonets. They would do and they would die, and whichever was left standing would be the victor. It took only seconds for the soldiers to meet. Yet, as they came together, it was not battle that Emil saw. No infantrymen sent another cartwheeling over the edge, or snarled itself in its enemy's arms. As one, the soldiers stopped. Each lifted a hand and grasped the hand of the soldier it had only moments ago been sworn to kill.
Well, the rotund man was demanding, what is the meaning of it?
Emil was already grappling the tow rope of the dirigible that had been floating above. Holding it firmly, he took a step off the shelving and heaved down, to land clumsily at the bottom of the aisle. By the time he had picked himself up, the man at the counter was demanding the return of his money, and a payment in recompense for the distress his sons had shown on Christmas morning. Emil lumbered in that direction, his chest heaving. The first rule of storekeeping was not, the customer is king. The real first rule was, don't assault the clientele. It was a rule Emil ignored as he forced his way through the crowd. By the time he reached the counter, Kathy was patiently counting coins back into the customer's outstretched hand. "Has something happened?" Emil asked, still straining for breath.